More about alcoholism, chapter 3, the top of page 30, most of us.
Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently may be has to be smashed.
We are set out as a different class of people by the physical allergy. There's nothing we can do to control our drinking. It's just not going to happen. No matter how much we think our way out of it, we'll never be able to control how much we drink if we find that we're alcoholics.
We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better.
So even though our drinking may have highlights where it seems like it's getting better, those are always followed by worse experiences. That's part of what it means to have the progressive illness. We call the disease of alcoholism progressive because over time it always gets worse, never better.
We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there have been brief recovery, followed always by still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they are in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic.
By how many forms?
Every form.
Every form. Every form. Every imaginable idea you can come up with, we'll try and use to prove that we're not alcoholic. So if you happen to be locked up here in the treatment center, and you spend most of your time locked up in the treatment center thinking it's just not that bad. Well, I'm not an alcoholic because I don't live under a bridge. I still have health insurance. I've still got a wife, a husband, kids, a family, a car, a house, whatever it is. Anything that you come up with as to the reason why you may not be alcoholic, I just invite you to consider that it may be this little thing here he says about every form of self-deception possible.
If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Here are some of the methods we have tried. Drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, never drinking alone, never drinking in the morning, drinking only at home, never having it in the house, never drinking during business hours, drinking only at parties, switching from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wines, agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job.
This is my favorite part.
Taking a trip. Not taking a trip. Swearing off forever with or without a solemn oath.
Do you ever do that?
A couple of times.
Yeah. Usually in jail in front of the toilet, right?
Taking more physical exercise. Reading inspirational books, going to health farms and sanitariums, accepting voluntary commitment to asylums. We could increase the list to ad infinitum.
How many is infinitum?
A lot.
A lot.
Totally.
Right? So whatever reasons you may have come up with, you should write Alcoholics Anonymous and tell them they should add these in.
We do not like to pronounce any individual as alcoholic, but you can quickly diagnose yourself. Step over to the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and stop abruptly. Try it more than once.
often at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, we'll hear somebody say something like, the big book says, if you're not sure that you're an alcoholic, go get drunk. Now, we just read the line, so we know the big book doesn't say, go get drunk. But it's interesting, as alcoholics, that when Bill Wilson says, try some controlled drinking, that we hear, go get drunk. That kind of goes back to the idea that we talked about earlier about how we listen when we read things, okay? So, what do you think Bill means when he says, try some controlled drinking? Try half a drink. I saw so many people in the room grimace when I said that I'm going to stick with the half a drink at this point, okay? Yeah, that's alcohol abuse, right? Take half a drink, half a beer, half a glass of wine, whatever it is, and stop. And leave it there. And walk away from it. It's crazy, Chris says. And don't start drinking again for a few days or a week or two. This is really what he's got in mind when he says try some controlled drinking. You see, because what Bill Wilson knows is that normal drinkers can drink half a drink and walk away and never look back at the table again and think, while their friend's waiting in the car for them, about lying and saying they're going to use the bathroom so they can go back and finish the other half. But that alcoholics think about drinking all the time once they take the first drink. We've got this physical allergy, and that's what sets us apart as a distinct entity from the rest of the people. And so what happens for us is we can't control the amount of liquor we consume after taking the first drink.
It will not take long for you to decide. If you're honest with yourself about it, it may be worth a bad case of jitters if you get a full knowledge of your condition. Though there's no way of proving it, we believe that early in our drinking careers, most of us could have stopped drinking. But the difficulty is that few alcoholics have enough desire to stop while there is yet time. We have heard of a few instances where people who showed definite signs of alcoholism were able to stop for a long period because of an overpowering desire to do so. Here is one.
Now notice in that paragraph that he says that few alcoholics will be able to stop because they won't have the desire to do so. Normal drinkers won't have a problem putting down drinking. It just won't be a problem for them. Normal drinkers don't sit around pondering on a regular basis whether they're actually alcoholic or not. Moving forward, right? He says they're going to give us a description here of a guy. They're going to talk about this guy. He's in his early 30s. Doctor told him he had a problem with drinking. He says he's got to stop. He says he can't have anything whatsoever. He says the guy was an exceptional man. He remained dry for 25 years. He retired at 55, comes out into retirement. Out comes the bedroom slippers and the booze. And he starts drinking again. Within 4 years, he's dead. Within 4 years, this guy stopped for 25 years. This illustrates the progressiveness of the illness for us. Right? You've heard the phrase in meetings that your disease is out in the parking lot doing push-ups while you're sitting in the meeting. What happens for an alcoholic is that the disease continues to progress during the dormancy period while we're not drinking. No matter how long I stay sober today, if I start drinking, it'll be as bad, if not worse, than it was when I stopped. However many years it's been, it doesn't matter. We never get better. We never regain control. No amount of time gives us back our control over our drinking, if we're actually alcoholic. So it tells us this case contains a powerful lesson, the top of page 33. Most of us had believed that if we remained sober for a long stretch that we could thereafter drink normally. But here is one man who at 55 years found he was just where he had left off at 30. We have seen the truth demonstrated again and again. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, we are in a short time as bad as ever. If we're planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind, nor any lurking notion that someday we will be immune to alcohol. You want to read again, Chris? 33, young people?
Young people may be encouraged by this man's experience to think that they can stop, as he did, on their own willpower. We doubt if many of them can do it, because none will really want to stop, and hardly one of them, because of a peculiar mental twist already acquired, will find he can win out. Several of our crowd, men of 30 or less, had been drinking only a few years, but they found themselves as helpless as those who had been drinking 20 years.
So what that means is you may still be young enough in your drinking that the physical compulsion has started, but that you can control how much, or you can stop at certain times. But the strange mental twist, the strange twist in our thinking that tells us that we don't have a problem kicks in. Or we feel ourselves justified in drinking. So regardless of how long we stay away from it, the idea to drink comes along and we think it's a good idea. Skipping forward to page 34.
As we look back, we feel we had gone on drinking many years beyond the point where we could quit on our own willpower. If anyone questions whether he has entered this dangerous area, let him try leaving liquor alone for 1 year. If he is real alcoholic and very far advanced, there is scant a chance of success.
Just leave liquor alone for 1 year. If you think you may have a problem and you're not sure if you're an alcoholic yet, just stop drinking for a year. Don't go to AA meetings. Don't do anything about it. Just stop. If you're not an alcoholic, it shouldn't be a problem.
In the early days of our drinking, we occasionally remained sober for 1 year or more, becoming serious drinkers again later. Though you may be able to stop for a considerable period, you may yet be a potential alcoholic. We think few to whom this book will appeal can stay dry anything like a year. Some will be drunk the day after making the resolutions.
That was me.
Most of them within a few weeks. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not.
You may have a little bit of loss of control. Things may not be going so well in your life, and it may seem like drinking is a part of it. This comes back to the idea about the real alcoholic. The determining factor for us is that what happens for us after we start drinking is we lose control altogether. And we've got this obsession, this thought that we can drink normally and it'll be okay, that somehow we'll find a way. So if you dwell on these things on a regular basis, the decision's probably already been made for you. Chances are you're not going to be able to quit on your own.
Many of us felt that we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever. Yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it. This utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish.
So throughout our lives and our drinking, people say to us, you know, you've got to quit for your husband or your wife. You've got to quit because you're going to lose your job. You've got to quit because you're going to die. But we just seem to have this utter inability to leave it alone. We just can't stay stopped. Some of us quit religiously. We quit on a regular basis. We just can't seem to stay stopped. You know, a few weeks ago, there was a story in the news about a guy who driving home, killed his best friend sitting in his truck next to him. The guy was decapitated because they hit something. And he was in a blackout. And so he went inside his house and he went to sleep. And he came out the next day and found his friend missing his head, sitting in his pickup truck, and didn't know how it had happened. No matter how great the necessity for us, there's this strange twist in our thinking that always gets us back to taking the first drink again. We have an utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how grave the consequences, no matter how great the necessity.
How then shall we help our readers determine, to their own satisfaction, whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking. For obvious, this is the crux of the problem.
Right. Obviously, this is the crux of the problem. The mental states, what we think about before we start to drink again. The mental states that precede a relapse into drinking. What's it mean to be a crux? Not a crook, but a crux. What's a crux? The center point. The focal point. The crux of the problem for the alcoholic is what happens in our minds before we go out and take out the first drink. So now they're going to tell us a couple of stories.
What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree, which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy, are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he? Of what is the thinking? Our first example is a friend we shall call Jim. This man has a charming wife and a family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He had a commendable World War record. He is a good salesman. Everybody likes him. He is an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. He did no drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he had become so violent when intoxicated that he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into contact with us.
It's like most of us who got out of treatment and started going to AA. Here's this guy, he's a pretty great guy, just starting to have some consequences as a result of drinking. Seems like he may be out of control. Gets sent to an asylum, which is what we call a treatment center nowadays. Comes out, meets the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, hears what they have to say, and thinks, wow, this is really great, but now that I know this, everything should be okay. So he said that we told him what we knew about alcoholism and the answers we had found. He made a beginning. His family was reassembled. He began to work as a salesman in a business that he used to own. Sounds like all of us who come to AA, right? Things start to get a little better for us. Everything's going great. And we're sure that with what we know now, we won't drink again. So here's the problem with Jim. Jim goes to work one day, and he goes out to sell a car. He stops at a bar along the way. Eating a sandwich, he gets the idea that if he puts some whiskey in his glass of milk, that he can drink and everything will be okay. Surely it won't hurt him because he's got a full stomach. Top of page 36, he says he got drunk again and he's going to tell us exactly what happened. Now he tells us something really important here. The top page 36, he says, I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman at the concern I once owned. Right? So Jim's got a resentment. I had a few words with the boss. Now he's got an argument. So he's angry and resentful and discontent. Remember what we read in the doctor's opinion? The alcoholic is restless, irritable, and discontent. Nothing serious. He says, I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car. On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at the roadside place where they had a bar. No intention of drinking, he says. He says he had no intention of drinking. As he's eating his sandwich, halfway down the page, 36, he says, suddenly the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. Remember the line we read earlier where he said, by every form of self-deception possible. I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but felt reassured as I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. The experiment went so well that I ordered another whiskey and poured it into more milk. That didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another. Remember our conversation we had a moment ago about the controlled drinking? Jim couldn't even get half of it down and then leave. After three, he's done. Thus started one more journey to the asylum for Jim. In other words, he's coming back to the treatment center for a little remedial care. Bottom of page 36, he says he had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. Top of 37, whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? Now, a lot of times for us, we read this and we think, well, that's stupid. Everybody knows you can't mix whiskey with milk. You know, it'll still screw you up. But how many of us think, well, if I only drink wine coolers, it'll be okay? Maybe I'll try a couple of cases of non-alcoholic beer. And that'll be fine. Right? Or I'll drink light beer. Some of us are vodka drinkers, and so we switch to a cheaper brand on the theory that if we drink crummy vodka, we won't like it as much, so we won't drink as much. The lady in the front row laughing, that's her deal, I can tell. We come up with every form of self-deception imaginable to prove that we can drink normally. That's just what we do. Now, the important part to understand here in Jim's story is what they're saying is that they're going to explain some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking. So what were Jim's mental states? He was angry, resentful, nervous, irritable, and restless. Yeah, and discontent. Sounds like the way we wake up most mornings, doesn't it? Those are the danger things. That's what we have to be aware of. What we do is we get in these strange twists, these strange periods in our life where we're feeling whatever we're feeling and we're upset about it, and then we think we should go shoot pool at a bar because it's a place that we can relax and have a good time. We just won't drink and it'll be okay. Once again, on the top of page 37, whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? Skipping down a little further, he says that there was always the curious mental phenomenon that parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. No matter how long we stay away from alcohol, no matter how many AA meetings we go to, no matter how much we know about alcoholism, parallel with all of those reasons why we can't ever drink again, runs this strange twist in our thinking that for the silliest reason imaginable, like mixing whiskey with milk, we'll throw it all away to take the first drink. The alcoholic has no mental control over the desire to take the first drink. No matter how long we stay away from drinking, it doesn't come back. Halfway down page 37, it says, in some circumstances, we've gone out deliberately to get drunk, feeling ourselves justified by nervousness, anger, worry, or depression. Sounds just like Jim, right? Jealousy or the like. It's even more dangerous for us, this strange twist in our thinking, when we set out intentionally to drink, because we feel like we're justified by how we feel. It says, but even in this type of beginning, we are obliged to admit that our justifications for a spree was insanely insufficient in light of what has always happened. We now see that when we began to drink deliberately instead of casually, there was little serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrific consequence might be. For some reason, we can't produce in our minds with sufficient force to deter us from taking the drink the memory of the suffering that we have as a result of the last time we drank, or of the history of our drinking and what happens to us over and over when we drink. We can't explain why that is, but that's the mental twist. That's the shift in our thinking that alcoholics have that normal drinkers don't have. If a normal drinker gets a DUI and has a bad experience as a result of drinking, they don't drink. They just stop. It doesn't work for them. An alcoholic, after his sixth or eighth DUI, starts to think, you know, maybe there's a problem here. It's this road that I keep driving down, obviously. Skipping over to page 38. Bottom of the page 38, some of you are thinking.
Some of you are thinking, yes, what you tell us is true, but it doesn't fully apply. We admit we have some of these symptoms, but we have not gone to the extremes you fellows did, nor are we likely to. For we understand ourselves so well after what you have told us that such things cannot happen again. We have not lost everything in life through drinking, and we certainly do not intend to. Thanks for the information. That may be true of certain non-alcoholic people who, though drinking foolishly and heavily at the present time, are able to stop or moderate because their brains and bodies have not been damaged as ours were. But the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge.
So what that means is that no matter how many AA meetings you go to, no matter how much you know that you're an alcoholic, we still have no mental control over the first drink. We have no mental defense against the first drink.
This is a point we wish to emphasize and re-emphasize, to smash home upon our alcoholic readers as it has been revealed to us out of bitter experience. Let us take another illustration.
So now they're going to tell us about this guy named Fred. Fred's a partner in a big accounting firm. Everything's great. He's got every reason to stop drinking and every reason to stay alive. Says, if ever there was a successful businessman, it's Fred. To all appearances, he is a stable and well-balanced individual, yet he is alcoholic. Skipping down on page 39. We first saw Fred about a year ago in the hospital where he had gone to recover from a bad case of the jitters. Not from alcoholism, but from a bad case of the jitters. It's like some of us who are here at the treatment center today. We just came in to rest and relax a little bit, to get away from the family. It was his first experience of this kind, and he was much ashamed of it. Far from admitting he was alcoholic, he told himself he came to the hospital to rest his nerves. The doctor intimated strongly that he might be worse than he realized. Skipping over to page 40. Fred comes to the hospital. He finds out that he may have a problem with alcoholism. He's glad for the information that he gets, but he tells the guys in AA, he says, you know, everything you told me, I'm sure I won't drink. I've been able to solve all the other problems in my life. I'm sure I'll solve this one just fine. The problem is that he gets drunk again. So they say on page 40, they say, let them tell you about it. It says, I was much impressed with what you fellows said about alcoholism, and frankly, I did not believe it would be possible for me to drink again. I rather appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity which precedes the first drink, but I was confident that it could not happen to me after what I had learned. I reasoned that I was not far advanced as most of you fellows, and that I had been usually successful in licking my other problems, and that I had every right to be self-confident that it would only be a matter of exercising my willpower. In this frame of mind, I went about my business, and for the time, all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks and began to wonder if I had not been making too hard a work out of this simple matter. Skipping to page 41, he's going to tell us about what happened. He says, I was on this business trip. I went to my hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind that it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. That was all. Nothing more. I ordered a cocktail with my meal. Then I ordered another cocktail. After dinner, I decided to take a walk. Then I returned to the hotel. It struck me that a highball would be fine before going to bed. So I stepped into the bar and had one. I remember having several more that night. He only meant to have one. Just one. Several more that night and the next day. Skipping down to the bottom of the page. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time, I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they had prophesied that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, I would drink again. They said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that happened, and more. For what I had learned about alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew, that moment, that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. I had never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then it was a crushing blow. Two of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous came to see me. They grinned, which I did not like so much. Then they asked me if I thought myself alcoholic and if I were really licked this time. I had to concede both propositions. Once again, the idea. We've got to experience deflation at depth. We've got to completely surrender to the hopelessness and futility of the way we've been living life. We've got to understand that we have no mental defense against taking the first drink. Skipping over to page 43 at the bottom of the page, he says, once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such defense. His defense must come from a higher power. Okay, welcome back. We're going to move on into the chapter of the agnostic. So the conversation is going to shift of the problem that we have with struggling with our alcoholism to the problem we have struggling with a relationship with God. Now, the good news is that there's only one thing the chapter to the agnostic is asking us to do. Does anybody know what that is? Change everything, right? No, just joking. The only thing that the chapter to the agnostic, the only thing the second step is asking us to do is to be willing. The bottom of page 44.
If a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us, no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral, we could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might. But the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed us utterly.
What he's talking about is that a lot of us have conversations with people throughout our drinking where they say to us, why don't you just go to church, or why don't you just do this, or why don't you just do that, and you could just become, you know, a better person. There's even a book that somebody wrote that's sobriety for people who don't want to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's a moral code that we can follow. There used to be a program called Moderators Anonymous, which is where you went in there and you just talked about drinking a little. Unfortunately, it's very sad. The person who started the program killed somebody in a drunk driving accident, and that tended to discredit the program a little bit. So what we found was that lack of power was our situation. We had no power to control our drinking. And just coming up with a new, improved way of thinking, that wasn't going to do it for us. A new moral code, a new philosophy on life, that just wasn't enough for us.
Lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem.
So, that's what the whole book is about. The whole book is about introducing you to a relationship with a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem with drinking. And, as we've already discussed in brief, it's going to provide you with a way of living which works in rough going, a way of life which really works. When I first got sober, they referred to it back in Clearwater where I got sober as a way of life second to none. That's what's available through Alcoholics Anonymous, a way of life second to none. We got to get down to the brass tacks of how we go about doing that. Skipping down to the bottom of page 45, we know how he feels.
We know how he feels. We have shared this honest doubt and prejudice.
So to somebody who comes into AA and struggles with believing in God, which is most of us, they're not alone. You're not unique. So if anybody in here has got any issues that prevent them from forming a relationship with power greater than yourself, you can relax. You're among friends. Everybody in AA has struggled with these questions, or most people in AA have struggled with these questions, and we've got a simple and easy answer for them.
Some of us have been violently anti-religious. To others, the word God brought up a particular idea of Him with which someone had tried to impress them during childhood. Perhaps we reject this particular conception because it seemed inadequate. With that rejection, we imagine we had abandoned the God idea entirely. We were bothered with the thought that faith and dependence upon a power beyond ourselves was somewhat weak, even cowardly. We look upon this world of warring individuals, warring theological systems, and inexplicable calamity with deep skepticism. We looked askance at many individuals who claimed to be godly. How could a supreme being have anything to do with it all? And who could comprehend a supreme being anyhow? Yet, in other moments, we found ourselves thinking, when enchanted by a starlit night, who then made all this? There was a feeling of awe and wonder, but it was fleeting and soon lost.
A lot of us really wrestle with this question. We're like, first of all, look at how screwed up the world is. Look at the wars, look at all the things that people create, all the catastrophe. If there was a God, God sure wouldn't design a world like this one. Or we think, well, maybe there is a God, but how can anybody comprehend a supreme being? If I'm finite, and if I'm constrained in my physical body and through these mental processes, I can only comprehend certain things that are finite, how can I even begin to dwell on this idea of a supreme being, of a higher power who's going to relieve all of my troubles and release me from the bondage of alcoholism? Much to our relief,
we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect a contact with Him. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps.
So what that means is that the only thing we need to work the second step is willingness. That's it. And then it says, provided we took other simple steps. We follow up this beginning of willingness by working steps 3 through 9. And we're introduced to a relationship with a power greater than ourselves. That's the way it works for us. And then steps 10, 11, and 12 are the maintenance steps that we continue to put in practice to develop or enhance this relationship that we embark on upon step 3. So all it takes is willingness. All it takes is willingness. Skipping over to page 47, he says, when therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. This applies too to other spiritual expressions you find in this book. Don't let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. At the start, this was all we needed to commence spiritual growth, to effect first conscious relation with God as we understood Him. Skipping down to the middle of the page, he says, we needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as a man can say that he does believe or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him that he's on his way. It's been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. That's all the second step is asking you to do, is become willing. If anybody struggles with understanding a relationship with God, this is the starting point. The starting point is a willingness. And when he tells us in the previous paragraph, when he says that all we have to do is let go of our prejudice, that also means that we have to let go of other concepts that we may have. We may not really struggle in a relationship with God. We may think we know God just fine. The problem for us is that knowing God just fine hasn't worked up until now. Something's missing. So what Bill is asking us to do here in the second step is just to temporarily suspend whatever we already think we know or believe about God, to work through steps 3 through 9, and in that process, God will show up in our lives. We'll have a new and revolutionary understanding of relationship with God that wasn't available to us before, prior to step 3. What the big book tells us to do is give up anything we know about God up until this point that's in our way. So what the big book is suggesting to us is consider your own conception of God. We don't have to have understanding. That understanding will come as a result of working the rest of the steps. That what we have to have is a willingness to have God enter our lives. And that's all it takes. All it takes is a willingness to allow God to enter your life. If you're doing 12-step work with somebody and they're struggling even just with having a willingness, then what you can ask them is, are they willing to believe that you believe in something? Because if you're willing to believe in the least bit, then you can make a beginning. That's what we just read, right? All it requires is the minimal amount of willingness. It says, we needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? That's all it takes. Everything else will be presented to you through the rest of the 12 steps. That's all the second step takes. So when we talk about the first and the second step merely being concepts that we need to come into an understanding with, that's what we're saying. Everything else is going to take place. The introduction, the relationship with the power greater than yourself is going to occur through working the rest of the 12 steps. The place that we struggle with is that the minute we embark on the process, all of a sudden some thought's going to come in with going, oh, this is stupid. Or no, it doesn't work like that. Well, that's prejudice coming up again, prejudgment. Prejudice from the past, some issue from the past coming into our present and overshadowing what our future can be. So just remain willing as we work through the rest of the steps to have God show up in your life however God sees fit. And it'll work out. It works for everybody. The chapter, How It Works. Skipping forward from page 58, which is the beginning of How It Works, to page 60, we've got the A, B's, and C's that we discussed. A, that we're alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. Anybody struggling with that still? Anybody hung up on the first step? Doesn't understand what it means to be an alcoholic? Isn't sure that that applies to them? Good. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, and C, that God could and would if he were sought. Everybody okay with being willing to embark on a relationship with a power greater than themselves? Okay, great. So, being convinced we were at step 3, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood him. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? Two important statements. What do we mean by turning our will and our life over to the care of God, and exactly how do we go about doing that? The first requirement. My sponsor convinced me, it took a lot of effort, but he convinced me when they use the word first, they mean they want you to start there. I had trouble with that. I used to skip forward in the book and wonder why I wasn't getting it. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Before we can enter into the third step, we have to become convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. So we have to define those words. What's self? Self is the I behind all of the statements of I want, I need, I see, I think. Self is the I. It's the me. It's what I identify in my core as being responsible or behind most of my thoughts and desires. What's will? Thinking. If I will myself to drink this cup of tea, then that's the thinking behind the action of drinking the tea. I have to will it for it to be. Does that make sense? You're not going to get anywhere without will. He's your best friend. Will is necessary for any action. We've got to have will. So understanding those two words, what's self-will? Thinking as it relates to self. I think this should be a certain way. I think that should be a certain way. See how that works? Thinking as it relates to the self. So, the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody. Why is that? Why would we always be in collision with something or somebody? If everybody in this room is running on self-will and we all get the idea that we want to drink this cup of tea, what's going to happen? Collision. Here's this bottle of water, full bottle of water. Chris, what happens when you think you should have some water? You take the water. Now, at the same time that Chris thinks he should have some water, I think I should have some water. So now what happens? Collision. We both get the idea or the design on a certain something in life, and we go after it, and we collide. And it happens in the simplest ways. Throughout our entire lives, what happens is we run our lives by self-propulsion, by self-will. We think about the way we think things should be, and then we take actions based on that thinking. And we try and bring those things into being. And the problem is that our neighbor is doing the exact same thing. Happens all the time on the freeway. Every time you get on the highway, there's two cars trying to get in the same lane at the same time. We live by self-will. We live by self-propulsion. The usual outcome is that we're in collision with something or someone. So he says, most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like the actor who wants to run the whole show. So he gives us this whole great analogy, or metaphor rather, about an actor trying to run the show. It's not an accident that he uses the actor as the metaphor. He's forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, and the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may be sometimes quite virtuous, meaning he may be a really great guy. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, or dishonest. But as with most humans, he's more likely to have varied traits. So it doesn't matter whether we're nice people or whether we're real jerks. What happens is we're convinced of the way we think life should be for ourselves, and then we act in a way to try to bring that about. Now notice he hasn't mentioned the alcoholic at all yet. He's just talking about most people. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. As human beings, we're brought up into a world where we're taught to believe that if you see something and you want it to be a certain way, you should try and make it be that way. That's what we believe. That's what we grow up in. That's what we live by. What usually happens? The show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more. He becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he's sure that other people are more to blame. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. We go through life, we get involved in situations, we look around, we figure out where other people are wrong, and then we move on to the next situation. Problem is another group of people shows up, we go through life with them, something goes wrong, we figure out where they're wrong, and then we move on to the next situation. We do it over and over and over again. Each person is like an actor trying to run the whole show. An actor has a role to fill. The actor isn't the director. The actor isn't the playwright. The actor isn't in charge of the choreography or of arranging the scenery. The actor is only supposed to fulfill their role. But most of us live by self-propulsion. We miss filling our role entirely, because we're consumed with getting the show to turn out the way we think it ought to. We live by self-propulsion. We live by self-will, thinking consumed by the self. What's his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Is he not the victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? What's it mean to be a victim? To suffer the consequence. That's what it means to be a victim. To be a victim means you are the one who receives the consequences of an action. Whether it's self-inflicted doesn't matter. That's just what it means to be a victim. So here he's telling us, isn't he not a victim of the delusion? What's a delusion? To believe in something that's not real. to have a fantasy telling you that it's this way when it's really not this way, right? So the victim of the delusion that he can rest means to receive or to get or take satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well. The actor trying to run the whole show, trying to arrange the show to suit his fancy. The victim of the delusion, suffering from the false belief that we'll be happy and satisfied if we only manage well. Most of us are thinking, well, that's not really me. But what happens when we wake up in the morning? The first thing we do is we think, well, if my roommate left already, then I can get in the bathroom and I'll be happy. But we come out and our roommate's still in the house, so we can't use the bathroom, so now we're not happy. Or we get lucky and our roommate left for work early, so the bathroom's all ours, and now we're happy. Then we think if our roommate didn't use the last of the coffee, then we'll be happy. We come out, go into the kitchen, we find out that the coffee's gone, and now we're pissed off. Or we get lucky again and our roommate didn't make coffee that morning, or even better, our roommate made coffee and left us some, so now we're happy. Then we leave the house, we walk out, we put our key into the ignition of the car, we turn the key and the car doesn't start. And all of a sudden we're not happy. We're really, really not happy. Because now the whole day has gone to hell. And we're miserable. And we immediately start thinking about everything else in the show that's not going to be the way we think it ought to be. We're going to be late for work, we're going to get yelled at, we're going to miss an important appointment, this is going to happen and that's going to happen. So now we're not happy. Luckily for us, the car starts. Whew. We escaped that one. So now we've missed like 4 or 5 landmines. We haven't even left the driveway of our house yet. We're back out of the driveway, we hit the road, we turn left to get down to the stop sign, turn left to get on the highway, and we think, oh, I hope there's not traffic. Which in Atlanta is a nightmare. We get onto the highway and there's traffic. Now we're not happy. We sit in traffic pissed off because there's traffic. Don't all these people realize we have some place to be? We're sure half of them don't even have jobs. They're just out driving at 8 o'clock in the morning. Luckily for us, we pull out onto the highway and there's no traffic. Clear sailing right into work. We zip down the highway, we turn off the exit, we pull into the parking garage at work. As we enter the garage, we see the boss's car. The first thing we think is, ooh, I hate him. There's the boss's car, and we remember he told us to do something yesterday and we forgot to do it. And now we're in trouble. Now we're not happy. Luckily for us, we pull into the garage and the boss's car is not there. So we bop on by to go to our parking space, happy as can be, because the boss is on vacation. And we're thrilled about that. We just remembered. So it doesn't matter what he told us to do yesterday before he left work. He's not coming back for 2 weeks. Right? Then we realize that SOB's in Jamaica for 2 weeks and we're not there. And now we're mad again. Now we're not happy because we don't get to go to Jamaica. And we sit around thinking about how much we do at work that nobody else does, and we're responsible for the whole place. And if it wasn't for us, it would all fall apart. And don't they realize how important we are? And we don't get the credit we deserve. We're the victims of the delusion that we'll be happy and satisfied if we manage well. We pull into the parking space. We head upstairs into the building. The boss is gone. We may not be in Jamaica, but work's a happier place because the boss is gone. And there's the guy at work that we dislike the most, just grinning at us. And he says, well, when the boss left, he told me I was in charge. And now we're really miserable, right? Because this guy's going to ruin the next 2 weeks we have at work. We sit down on our desk. Luckily, he breaks his leg and has to go to the hospital, so we don't have to deal with him for the next 2 weeks. So now we're happy again. Then the phone rings. We answer the phone, and it's the person we were supposed to call yesterday to take care of what the boss told us to take care of, and he's mad because we didn't take care of what we were supposed to take care of. So now we're not happy anymore. We're the victims of the delusion that we can wrest happiness and satisfaction out of life if we only manage well. We literally live from situation to situation, from moment to moment in our lives, waiting for life to be the way we think it ought to be happy. We literally live from moment to moment in life, waiting to be happy, waiting for life to show up the way we think it ought to. We're the victims of the delusion that we'll be happy and satisfied if we manage well. we really think that it's up to the world meeting our expectations for us to be happy. And we live that way, from moment to moment to moment, waiting for the world to show up the way we think it ought to. We're the actor who wants to run the whole show, constantly arranging the lights, the ballet, and the rest of the players according to our will, according to our thinking, according to the way we think it ought to be. We live from moment to moment, waiting, expecting to be happy, if and only if life shows up the way we think it ought to. We're the victims of the delusion that we'll be happy and satisfied if we only manage well. It's a real depressing thought, because it literally means that from moment to moment to moment, our cart of apples can be overturned at any second. It's a life built in futility and disappointment. We live from moment to moment to moment waiting to be disappointed. Whew, it's rough, huh? Luckily for us, the book doesn't end there. What's his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of the world if he only manages well? The first requirement is that we become convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. A life run on self-will results in being the victim of the delusion that we'll be happy and satisfied if we only manage well. Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things he wants, and do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is he not, even in his best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony? Our actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. He's like the retired businessman who lolls in the Florida sunshine in the winter complaining of the sad state of the nation. The minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century, politicians and reformers who are sure all would be utopia if the rest of the world would only behave. The outlaw safecracker who thinks society has wronged him, and the alcoholic who has lost all and is locked up. Whatever our protestations, in other words, whatever our arguments, however we disagree with that, are not most of us concerned with ourselves, our resentments, or our self-pity. We're the victims of the delusion that we'll be happy and satisfied if we only manage well. We live by self-will, we live by self-propulsion. We're concerned with ourselves, our resentments, and our self-pity. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Driven, literally driven, by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past we've made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves. And the alcoholic, it's the first time we've mentioned the alcoholic. The alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot. The alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of selfishness. What does that mean, above everything? It means before we can go forward, most of all, most importantly, we've got to get rid of selfishness. We're not going to be able to stay sober if we're still as selfish as we are. We've got to get over self-centeredness. We've got to. We've got to, or it kills us. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them, even though we would have liked to. Like everybody in here got told when you were 4 years old, you have to share. You've got to share. It's nice to share. We kind of got coerced into it. Well, people like people who share, but none of us like to share. There's one bottle of water. Both Chris wants it and I want it at the same time. One of us is going to try and take it from the other because we just don't want to share. We're driven by self-will. We're the victims of the delusion that we'll be happy and satisfied if we manage well. If we only adjust, manage, change, alter life enough to suit ourselves, then we'll be happy and satisfied. If we can only get the people around us to do what we think, then we'll be happy and satisfied. If we can only get our kids to behave, then we'll be happy and satisfied. If the Democrats would stop doing what they're doing, then the Republicans would be happy. And for the Democrats, it's the same thing. If the Republicans would stop doing what they're doing, then they'd be happy. We literally live from moment to moment to moment, waiting for life to show up in a way that'll make us happy. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work. It says, many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them, even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. This is the how and the why of it. So first he's going to tell us how we get God's help and get rid of self-centeredness, and then he's going to tell us why. First, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Now most of us sit here and think, but wait, I'm not playing God. I may be a little selfish, but I'm not really playing God. But aren't we? Aren't we really when we're trying to arrange the outside world to suit ourselves? Aren't we really playing God? If the alcoholic really thought it would work, instead of watering our plants, we would sit in front of them and go, grow, 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 grow. We would. We really would. We're playing God. Worth looking at the outside world thinking, if I can just arrange it, if I can get it to be the way I think it ought to be, then I'll be happy and satisfied. That's playing God. We're driving 6 cars when we go down the highway. Ours and the 5 others in front of us. Well, the 4 others in front of us and the 1 guy tailgating us. Thinking, if only they would do this, then I'll be happy and satisfied. We literally live from moment to moment to moment trying to arrange the outside world so we can be happy and satisfied. We're playing God. So the first part of working the third step is to quit playing God, to give up trying to control the outside world and get it to be the way we think it ought to be. Even though you're probably right and it would be better off if everybody just did it your way. The first part of working the third step is giving up playing God. It didn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He's the principal, we are his agents. He's the father and we are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone, meaning the center point, the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. So that's not a statement of reward and punishment. What he's saying is that the result of giving over running the world to God is you don't have to worry about running the world anymore. Give up running the world and then you don't have to worry about running the world anymore. Give up playing God and then you don't have to worry about running the world anymore. And as a result of doing that, you'll get whatever you need in your life to take care of what you need to take care of in your life. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and hereafter. We were reborn. So then we've got the famous third step prayer. Funniest thing about the third step prayer is that when you skip down to the next paragraph, where it says we found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with another understanding person, on page 63 it says, the wording, of course, was quite optional, so long as we expressed the idea of voicing it without reservation. Most of us never think about what the idea behind the third step is. The idea behind the third step is that we have to quit playing God and look to see where we can contribute. We have to fulfill our role in life rather than arranging the play to suit ourselves. Quit playing God and look to see what you can contribute. That's how we work the third step. We literally forget that the world existed before we were born, and it ran just fine without us. And it's going to be around long after we die. And it's going to run just fine without us then, too. We never just be the actor trying to fulfill his role in life or her role in life. We walk around playing God, trying to run the whole show, trying to arrange the lights, the rest of the characters, the ballet, and the music to suit our fancy. That's what we do. We live life as if we were in charge. And we live from moment to moment to moment, waiting for life to show up the way we think it ought to so we can be happy. And it never works out. Because it's just a matter of one little thing being out of whack for us to get upset. So the way we work the third step, what Alcoholics Anonymous suggests that we're doing, is give up playing God, stop trying to run the outside world, and instead, in any situation we're in life, look to see what we can contribute. What's my role to fill? I'm an actor, not the director. How can I fulfill my role in the world? What is there for me to contribute in any situation I go through? You can read the third step prayer all you want, but if you're like me, what you do is you read the third step prayer, then you leave your house in the morning, you get in the car, and you go out and start running the show. The third step prayer doesn't work the third step. We work the third step by not playing God and looking to see what we can contribute. This was only a beginning, though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. Next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action. So what's it mean to launch? Wait around for a month or two, right? One step a year. To step forward. What does it mean to launch? To launch, to propel rapidly. Propel rapidly. I'm going to launch this bottle. I propelled it rapidly. There's no waiting around. There's no standing still. We launch on a course of vigorous action. The first step of which, remember that word first, it's always the beginning, was a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted.